Right. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming out tonight. It's great to see so many of us here. And just to reiterate, I am the fill-in. So my deepest apologies that it's not Uncle Dion tonight. If you know Uncle Dion, you know that I'm definitely the B team. So sorry about that in advance, but hopefully we can get some practical lessons from tonight from the man Solomon. I think there's something in it for everyone, no matter where you are in your spiritual journey, or how old you are, or how you feel you are at this current moment. And it's good that you are here, even if it is just for socialization. We're hoping that it can be more than that, but it's good that if you're just here to see your friends and talk, that's a great start, so thank you for coming. Okay, I don't have a clicker, so I'm going to have to do it automatically. I have a question. Does anyone know this little boy? I'll be very impressed if you do. Anyone know him? No? This little boy is Anand Celeste Corley. Still no bells? No?
F1 driver.
No, not an F1 driver. Although he's very close to my heart. No, this little boy is Anand Celeste Corley. It's not Johnny Weatherton as a child. No, I know you're probably thinking that. And what's special about this boy is he has the highest recorded IQ of any living person, recorded IQ. Just reference the average IQ. Does anyone know what the average IQ is? It's both the same for men and women? No, a bit lower?
100.
Yep, 100, roughly 100, between 85 and 115. So about 100. Stephen Hawking was 160, was his IQ. Einstein was 180. Anand Celeste Corley has got an IQ of 263. So he's a very talented young man. He said his first word when he was 2 weeks old. Yeah. He was walking by the time he was 6 months. Most kids walk when they're about a year, is that right? And by the time he was 1 year, he was one year old and forming full complex compound sentences. So you could have a conversation with 1 year old Anand. Obviously, Anand, intelligent boy, went to university and studied advanced chemistry when he was 8. University of Tech in Singapore. He was 8 when he did that. So needless to say, he's a smart little boy. What about this man? You might know this one. Not Dumbledore, no? Not Dumbledore, not Gandalf. Have a crack. Go on. Someone old, looks antique-y. He's well known.
Galileo.
Not Galileo. Leonardo da Vinci. Well, it's not actually him, it's a painting of him, but that is who that represents. Obviously, very well known, very smart man. He's what we know as a polymath, meaning that he had prodigious talent and prodigious knowledge in a whole range of different topics, a lot of knowledge. So he was an author, an architect, an engineer, a scientist, a theorist, an anatomist, a philosopher, a sculptor, and of course, a painter. That's what he's most well known for. He's credited to have introduced a whole era of an art. So the High Renaissance was brought in by the works of Leonardo da Vinci, and then his contemporaries followed it on. Recently, Salvador Mundi, I think, is a painting of his. It sold for $450 million at an auction. That's US. So that's over 600 million Australian. For one painting about this big. So that broke all the records. So to this day, very well known, very successful, and a very smart man was Da Vinci. One more. Who was this? Going back even further.
Julius Caesar.
Not Julius Caesar. Similar kind of...
Aristotle.
No, not Aristotle. Close. No, not Plato. Keep going. It's along those lines. Spheres. Think spheres. No, Archimedes. Oh, you boys are terrible. Archimedes. This man is Archimedes. So he is known as the father of mathematics as we know it today. Very well-known man. A lot of the theories and the theorems that I don't know that they use in math were all based off a lot of his works that he found way back when, before the times of Christ. So very intelligent man. And a lot of his kind of musings and his thoughts were light years, centuries ahead of his contemporaries. So he was a very, very smart man. And I've kind of repeated it a lot, but what's the common thread between these three individuals? What's the common denominator? Very, very smart people. Very knowledgeable. All had very extensive knowledge and experience. They're considered, even today, as exceptions to the rule. But what if there was someone that was better than all three of these, probably combined? Someone who, that despite little Anand's IQ of 263 and his memory and Da Vinci's genius and his talent on with the paintbrush and Archimedes basically inventing math, was more intelligent and more well-reasoned than all three of these. He was younger than Da Vinci and Archimedes when he was this intelligent, and he didn't have the same education as Cawley. He didn't go to Harvard University. He didn't get a scholarship to go and study at Oxford or whatever. He didn't have any sort of scholarship funding. And yet God actually says about this man that I'm going to make you so wise and give you such a discerning heart that there's never going to be anyone like you in history from his point backward and forward, with Jesus Christ being the exception. Now, if you've been paying attention to the topic and what we've been saying, you've probably guessed who this man is. His mind and his judgment on literally any topic was such that people would make journeys of thousands of kilometres from all across the world back in the day, so on foot, on horseback, on donkeys, in carriages, to hear, just to hear him speak, to sit at his feet and sit near him and watch him and hear him speak and hear what he was having to say to people. This is the kind of mind that we're talking about. Queens and kings came to hear him and were absolutely dumbfounded. Literally, it says their mouths were open. They were like, this is unbelievable. This has never been heard of before. So we're talking, obviously, about King Solomon, who may or may not have looked like that. And what if I told you that King Solomon, despite all this wisdom, despite all this knowledge and experience, still messed up in a big way? King Solomon, all this knowledge and all this wisdom that was actually God-given, that was divine, that came from above, still messed up, still fell. And the beauty of King Solomon, and you might think, this man is unrelatable. No, the beauty of it is that he fell. He failed. He didn't actually live the perfect life, even though he had this experience, this wisdom. So he's a lot like us. You'd think it would be smooth sailing, have this incredible mind and this incredible intellect and this ability to discern and judge between right and wrong and between people. But that's not actually the case. He still falls. And things begin to slip away from him. And it all starts to spiral down. And things get out of control. And all of a sudden, he's gone from this faithful man with God-given wisdom, and now he's offering sacrifices and burning incense to idols and Baal, and he's marrying 1,000 women. And you think, whoa, take a step back. How did you get there? Aren't you this man with divine wisdom from God? How did you get to this situation, Solomon? But let's not get ahead of ourselves, because we're going to talk about all this in the next half hour or so. Come to 1 Kings 1, if you've got your Bibles. If not, have a look on with someone next to you or on your phones. We'd love you to bring a Bible, though. 1 Kings chapter 1. By the way, when I do classes, I very much like to keep them interactive. So I would love input. I'm going to ask people to read verses. I'm going to ask questions, and I would love to have some feedback, some input, answer. If you're wrong, it doesn't matter. If anyone's heard me in a CLC class, 9/10 of my answers are wrong. It doesn't matter. Just give it a red-hot crack. We love it like that. Okay, 1 Kings 1. We're going to have some reading in a bit. Let's set the scene for this King Solomon. So who was Solomon's father? Nice, easy question. King David. Good. So David announces that his son Solomon, David's got a lot of sons, right? He's got some good sons, some bad sons. And he announces, okay, my son Solomon is going to be the heir to the throne of Israel. And then he dies. And Solomon is left to manage this big kingdom of Israel and Judah, right? Who are at this stage united. So just a few notes then about the kingdom of Israel at this point in time. It is not yet split. If you didn't know it already, Israel gets split into Judah and Israel. They're the two, the north and the south kingdom. very soon after Solomon. But at this stage, it is one united kingdom. All 12 tribes are together. David, in the previous reign, has beaten the majority of Israel's enemies into submission. So the Hivites, the Hittites, the Amalekites, the Canaanites, the Philistines, the majority of them have been beaten into submission, if not wiped out. So that was a lot of David's reign. So Solomon is left with this pretty peaceful kingdom at this stage, but it's not perfect. We're going to read from... No, we're not. I'm going to read it. 2 Samuel 7, verse 9, it says, I have been with you wherever you went, and I have cut off all your enemies. This is God talking to Solomon. I'll make for you a great name. I'll appoint a place for my people. You will be disturbed no more. Violent men shall afflict them no more. So essentially, there's no war. There is no cause for war anymore because they've kicked these enemies out of their land. So the kingdom is being conquered and established and set up. So this was almost like an interim period between a time of war and a time of peace. And it was up to Solomon then to lift his game and bring them through this trial period. Now, King David had wanted to... This is a question for you. King David, his father, had wanted to do something in his reign, but couldn't do it. God said, I don't want you to do this. Does anyone know what that is? Austin. Build a temple. Very good. I'm not going to lie, that's the first time I've seen someone raise their hand. That's awesome, but feel free to yell it out as well. Actually, no, you know what? Raise your hand and I'll point at you. Oh, the power. Okay, awesome. So David wants to build a temple for God, a house for God, because what the state of Israel at the moment is that they've got this awesome nation and they've started to set up and they've kicked these enemies out, but they don't have a central place of worship. So in Jerusalem, there is no temple as yet. So David says, awesome, okay, I've taken the city of Jerusalem. I really want to build this great, big, amazing, rich house for God. And God says, no. Why does God say no? He's a man of war. Yes, he's a man of blood. So like we said, David has spent the last 10-odd years, 40-odd years, kicking out all the enemies. He's a man of blood. He's got a lot of blood on his hands. And God's house isn't going to be a place of war and bloodshed. Sacrifice, but not war. So God says, I don't want you to do it. So then David goes and he says, okay, that's fine, but I'm going to help. So he gets and he gathers all cedar timbers together. He starts saving a lot of money and stone and getting stone workers and hewers of wood so that when his son comes to power, Solomon, he can start building this big house. So that's where we're at when Solomon takes the throne. We're going to pick up the story now with a bit of reading. 1 Kings... I'm going to go to chapter 3. Let's read verses 1 to 4. So we'll just go one verse each. Who would like to read? You're volunteering for your entire row of four. Sally, starting and just work it out. Four verses. Okay, thank you. So there's a few things that we need to pick up in these verses about Solomon. Let's focus in. So Solomon, what does he do in verse 1?
Makes an alliance with Egypt.
Yes, how does he make an alliance with Egypt?
Marriage.
Marriage. So he makes this political marriage with the daughter of Pharaoh. So she's an Egyptian princess. Now that's interesting because it's a bit iffy. It makes a lot of sense, right? What's he done by marrying this very powerful man's daughter? Well, he's secured a standing army. He's made a very good ally to his south, so he's not going to have an enemy there. And that also comes with a big old dowry and a lot of money that comes with that. So it's an intelligent move in terms of politics and economics. But it comes with a lot of risk, doesn't it? This is the daughter of Pharaoh. It's not necessarily the greatest moral decision. The Egyptians traditionally haven't been followers of God or particularly kind to the Israelites. And we're going to see that later on, this is going to have a huge effect. This kind of habit of marrying foreign women, or just a lot of women in general, is going to, regardless of how much political sense it makes, is going to really backfire quite badly. Okay, so number two, what are the people doing at this point in the nation's history?
Sacrificing in high places.
Yes. Who else is sacrificing in high places? It's in the verses.
Solomon.
Yes. So Solomon and his people are sacrificing in high places. Interesting. Who are they worshipping? Yeah. So it's an interesting quandary. So they don't yet have these places to worship God. So it seems what they're doing is they're worshipping God, but they're doing it in the old places, the old high places, which were traditionally the pagan places. So there would have been a Baal idol with an altar on a high place. And okay, so David comes in, he's killed the Amalekites that live there, knocks down the idol, but the altar's still there. And it's in a higher place. So it says there was a great altar in Gibeon. So what they were doing, they were kind of repurposing, it seems, these high places and these altars that were part of the old kind of religious setting. So already in Solomon's reign, it's just a hint, just a little bit of a hint of pagan idolatry creeping in. And you can see it's a bit iffy because they're still worshipping God, right? They're still sacrificing. It's not like they're worshipping Molech and all the other. It's still God, it's still Yahweh, but it's just in the old high places. And because it says, although they were worshipping God, they were doing it in high places. And there was a great high place in Gibeon. And it's not just the people, it's Solomon. So Solomon is leading almost by example because he's doing this. Okay, we're going to read on now. Verses, another set of readers. We've got four verses, I think. 5 to 9. Don't all rush.
1 Kings 3, that's 5 to 9.
I give you the word of Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, ask what I shall give you. And Solomon said, you have shown great mercy to the servant David my father, because he walked before you in truth, in righteousness, and in all uprightness. You have continued his great kindness for him, and you have given his sons to him.
Okay, so Solomon is at Gibeon, and he finishes with these sacrifices doing to God. He goes to sleep that night, and God appears to him in a dream, and he says, ask for something. Ask me for something, whatever you want, and I can give it to you. So, it's funny, when I think about this, not to trivialize it, but I immediately think of, like, it's genie in a bottle almost. It's God is this all-powerful creator, this deity that knows and can do anything. And he's saying to young Solomon, hey, here's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Ask me something. What do you want? What do you need? What do you think is going to help you in your reign? He actually doesn't even say that. He just says, what do you want? Ask me for something. I'm here to help. So just imagine that. Just try to take a step back from that and put yourself in the shoes of young Solomon. He's only early in his reign here. You can imagine what he's thinking, right? Oh, man, what do I want? What do I ask for? What do I want? This is the Almighty God that's asked me, what do you want? You know, I'm sure you've had in your conversations with your friends the classic question, if you had three wishes, what would you ask for? And the first wish is always what? Yep, more wishes. So this isn't what Solomon does. More wishes, right? So we've all thought of that. And if it's not wishes, it's you know, what would you do with $100 million? If the possibilities were endless, what would you do, right? So we've all thought about this kind of question in some broad sense. So I want you to just think now, just to yourself, have a think. What would you ask of God? Actually, let's make an exercise. Everyone, put your heads down. Heads down, thumbs up. Put your heads down, close your eyes. Just do it. Get into it. Okay, what do you want? God says, tell me what you want. And before you jump to your answer, my question is not what should you ask for, but what would you ask for? What's most important in your heart right now? Just think about that. What is your honest answer to Solomon's situation?
You can have a look at this if you'd like.
What is your answer to Solomon's question? What do you want? Money?
Help? Drago? Long life? Beauty? Good looks? A career?
A partner, intelligence, properties, travel opportunities. What is it? What do you really want? Let's go to verse 9. This is Solomon's answer. Give therefore your servant an understanding heart to judge your people that I may discern between good and bad. Who is able to judge this so great a people? So he says, I don't want any of that. I want wisdom. Solomon asks for wisdom. Now, why does Solomon ask for wisdom? Think about it. He's a king. He's just become a king of a massive nation. Why not ask for a massive army? Like, that would make sense, surely. A big old army with the latest weapons, you know, the best armor, the best iron forges and the best tactics, and they're just going to go and absolutely conquer all the surrounding regions. And look, you can do it in God's name, so you're expanding God's kingdom. You can take a bunch of people kind of into the flock and teach them about the gospel. Surely that would be justifiable. Don't you want to make God's nation bigger? Why not ask for a big army? What about money? Why didn't Solomon ask for just buckets and buckets of money and riches? You know, he could have built all sorts of public works for his nation. He could have made their lives so much better, so much easier. He could have donated to the priests. He could have raised the widows up, built houses for the homeless, all sorts of medicine, and all that kind of thing. Why not heaps of money? That would make sense. But he doesn't. Solomon asks for wisdom. He says, look, to be honest, I'm actually a bit unsure of myself. I know that my judgment isn't actually up to the task of ruling your people. I'm just a young man with very little life experience and enormous responsibility on my shoulders. When it comes down to it, I am not enough, says Solomon. My knowledge, my experience, and my decision making is not up to the task and not adequate to do justice to your people. It's a very humbling moment for Solomon. And just remember that Solomon is not a dumb guy. Like, he's the son of a king. He had a great education. He's not a dumb man, but he says, I'm not up to the task. I need some sort of input from you, God. It's a very humbling lesson for Solomon. That's actually a very hard lesson to grasp, I think. Especially, well, just speaking for myself. You know, my generation and your generation as well, probably the same generation, to be honest. it's almost reached that stage. There is a massive, massive push, for better or for worse, towards education and degrees and qualifications and work qualifications and whatnot and all that. One of the big buzzwords for the lockdown last year was upskilling. Anyone know what upskilling is? It's kind of in the name. Skill. Couldn't have said it better myself. You know, so upskilling is exactly that. You're taking your skill level up in a particular area. You know, getting another qualification for, you know, your accounting job or whatever. Getting another set of tools under your belt to help you progress upward in your career or whatever thing you're working towards. Or, you know, getting another degree to make yourself just that bit more, that get that edge, that competitive edge over the other businesses around about. Now, that's fine to some extent. And I think the education has got a really beneficial side. There's no denying that. But we can't let this attitude of, I can do it myself, and it's off my own skills and my own back and my own hard work that I'm going to make it. You can't let that take over the way that you think. Sometimes the more we focus on generating our own personal intelligence and getting smarter and more skilled, which is fine to an extent, it has sometimes has the effect of, well, the less you rely on God. You know, if I'm this qualified, super skilled, super competitive kind of person, what need do I have for God who makes me humble? Where's the appeal in that? So when God asks him, what do you want? And Solomon says, wisdom. That's a wise answer. That's already a wise answer. Because he knows what he knows right now about life and leadership is just not enough. And it's the same for us. What we can learn now, in whatever field it is not going to be enough to make you better in God's eyes. My degree doesn't make me any better in God's eyes. Your career, your ATAR, your mark in extension chemistry does not make you better to God. Wisdom is what will make a difference. So that's a very humbling process. So ingrained in us as humans and in me is a desire to A, have all the answers, and B, to be right about all those answers. A big part of our psyche is this pride thing where it's kind of inconceivable to ask for help, where it's inconceivable to be wrong. You know, telling someone that you don't actually know, let alone asking them for help, is something that we struggle to do. But it's silly because who knows just how much we know? That's God. God knows that sometimes we don't have all the answers. And he wants us, and he knows it's a beneficial process, to step away from that and say, you know what, Solomon was right. I don't have all the answers. I need God's wisdom. What I have here and now needs that edge that God gives. We need God's wisdom. And Solomon wasn't afraid to say that. So we must be careful that our pursuit of godly wisdom is first and foremost above all other forms of education. So Solomon asked for wisdom, right? And God says, that's great. That is an awesome thing to ask for. I'm going to give it to you. And what he then says is, furthermore, because you haven't asked for riches and for honor and for glory, I'm going to give you those as well. So he gives him wisdom, and then he says, you're also going to be incredibly wealthy and incredibly famous and incredibly well known. And if you continue to be very faithful, you're also going to have a long life. So this is how Solomon starts his reign then. He gives wisdom, he's given wisdom, honor, and riches. However, there is a spanner in the works. All is not well. Can you see a problem with how that would present, a problem that that would present with? He's given wisdom, but the riches and the honor can drag him down. There's nothing innately wrong with those things, but they bring with them a raft of temptations and possibilities. So now Solomon would have the added challenge of making sure his heart didn't follow after those things and not just God's wisdom. So he needs to be careful he didn't grow proud and greedy. Let's read about what Solomon does next and how he progresses. Okay, come across the chapter, the page, to chapter 4. So this is how Solomon then progresses going forward. 1 Kings chapter 4, and let's read verse 29 through to the end. New readers, please. 1 Kings 4, 29 to the end.
Gone. But he was wiser than anyone else, including Ethan and Ezra.
awesome. Okay. There's actually, I'll just read one more quote just to cement it in. I'm sure you get the idea. 1 Kings 10. Thus King Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth, all the kings in riches and in wisdom. And the whole earth sought the presence of Solomon just to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his mind. Okay, so Solomon grows insanely rich, like stupid rich, like too much money to know what to do with. Does anyone know what the average, the net, Daniel, I know you know, what the net worth of Solomon is estimated to be? Probably not. Conservatively, $2 trillion was Solomon's net worth. I've seen it up to three. Two was probably about average, probably a bit below average. $2 trillion. That's a lot of money. That's in today's money. So it says that he was so wealthy that cedar trees became incredible, which were very expensive trees and very good to work with back in the day. They were incredibly plentiful in the land. You know, gold was flowing, silver was flowing. There were gemstones like rocks everywhere. So he's got buckets and buckets of money. He's a very wealthy man, and so is the nation. And he's also very famous. People start rocking up from everywhere, kings and queens, just to hear him speak, because it's God's wisdom that he's got. Okay, so he grows in money, wisdom, and fame. But, like we said, all is not well. With these gifts came a very important responsibility to guard his heart. God gave him wisdom. God didn't give him a perfect heart. That's the difference. So what we're going to find out as we read on is that, you know, this is God-given wisdom, right? This is literally divine wisdom. This is God's wisdom that Solomon has. So you'd think that surely that's enough. Surely that's enough to live just a good, faithful life. But get this, to understand is not enough. Just let that, just think about that for a second. To understand is not enough. I'm going to go further and say to have wisdom is not enough. Don't get me wrong. It's important and it's necessary, but it's a step. He had incredible insight. He had incredible wisdom. And still, what we're going to see is he fell. He took those first steps, but he didn't continue taking those steps. No one knew better than Solomon right from wrong, even in the most tricky situations. Quick poll. If you think you know even a bit about God, the Bible, the gospel, put your hand up. Just a bit, something. Cool. So I would say that's most people. To those people, compared to Solomon, you know nothing. Absolutely nothing compared to Solomon. His level of understanding was incredible, but his understanding wasn't enough. So we've got to ask the question, how does he go wrong? And this is the key to understanding Solomon and the key to understanding his fall. Okay, so wisdom isn't a guarantee of correct behavior. We know this because God set out some rules and rules that Solomon broke. We're going to read these. Does anyone know where these rules are? I'll be impressed if you get this. God set out about five rules for kings. Five rules for kings. I don't know if we've mentioned them in the talks yet. Not 1 Samuel. There might be ones there, but they're not the ones I'm thinking of, so you're wrong. Yes, but no. Specifics. Give me a quote. He's good. Everyone go to Deuteronomy 17. Sam Gilmore, he's going to read them for us. That's one way to make sure people don't ever answer a question again. Make them read it. Okay. Sam, what verses are we looking at? If you have a marker, a Bible marker, write this in. We're going to colour some things. Or remember it and do it later. What verses, Sam? 16
and 17.
Yep.
Right.
Let's start from 14, though. You're not wrong, though. It's where we're looking at. Let's go 14 to... Yeah, 14 for context, and we're going to go to 18. You can share the reading around if you want.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Nice.
When you come in, can you come shall be when he sitteth upon the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write him a copy of this law in a book out of that which is before the priest the Levite.
Great, stop. Okay, I can see five rules in those verses. I want you to call them out, starting from the start. See if we can get five rules for the kings of Judah that God put down so they wouldn't mess up. Rule number one. Hit me. Yes, more specifically. An Israelite. Good. That's number one. What's number two? Yes. Interesting. He can't have many horses. And what specifically about those horses is important that he feels he has to mention?
They'd have to return to Egypt.
No. What can't they be from?
They can't have Egyptian horses.
Yeah. Weird. They can't have Egyptian horses. Rule number three.
Wives.
What about wives?
Not for any.
Don't have heaps of wives. Good rule. Number four.
Silver and gold.
What about silver and gold?
It's all excesses of everything.
I'm an unlearned man. Talk to me. Break it down to me. Don't get heaps of silver and gold. To, and importantly, to himself. Last one. There might be more, but I'm stopping after this one. Great. Okay, five rules for a good king given by God. The first one makes sense, right? They've got to be an Israelite. They know their customs, they know their culture, their traditions, they know the religion, they know God. Why do you think, this is a question, that he shouldn't hoard horses, and especially not from Egypt? What do you think about that? Why shouldn't you? Awesome. That's dead on. Summarise that very nicely. That's a great answer. Okay, one heaps of wives. We're going to go into this later. Actually, no, we're not going to answer that. We're going to answer it later. One heaps of gold and silver.
Another thing to trust on instead of God.
Mm, definitely. Another thing that offers protection in some form. And write a copy of the law is straightforward, I think. Okay, so five rules for a good king. We're going to find out that Solomon breaks a lot of these. Let's go to 1 Kings 10. He's a good king. He starts as a good king. He's got good intentions. He's flawed, but he's got good intentions. Let's see what he does during his reign. 1 Kings 10, 23. So King Solomon exceeds all the kings of the earth for riches and wisdom. And all the earth sought Solomon to hear his wisdom. And they bought every man his present, vessels of silver, vessels of gold, garments, armor, spices, horses, mules, a rate year by year. And Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen, and he had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen he bestowed in cities. And he makes silver in Jerusalem as stones, and cedars he made as sycamore trees. They're very common. Important. Solomon had horses brought out of Egypt, but exactly against that, and linen yarn, and the king's merchants received linen yarn at a price. And a chariot came up and went out of Egypt for 600 shekels of silver, and a horse for 150 out of Egypt, and he sells it to all the kings round about. Okay, so very obvious problem here. What's he gone and done? What rules he broken? Potentially five. First up, number two, very obviously. He did exactly what God said, don't go and get heaps of horses, especially don't get them from Egypt. Someone goes, I'm going to get heaps of horses, and they're going to be from Egypt. So he goes and breaks rule number two. We're going to go into verse three. Now, number four is interesting because what did God bless him with again at the start of his reign? What was one of his blessings? riches. Yeah, interesting. So God says, don't hoard silver and gold, but then he gives him riches. So what's probably happened is, along the line, greed has overtaken Solomon. So this desire for more, he's realized that, money attracts money, and he's lost sight of that initial blessing that God gave him. So Solomon starts to get greedy. He's got money, but now he wants more of it and more of it because people are just giving it to him and it's flowing in the streets like it's nothing. So you know, it's a fascinating look into the way that we as humans are wired. We mentioned earlier there's a question, if you had $100 million, what would you do with it? I've definitely asked this question and had it asked to me before. And invariably, the question you'll get, okay, you've got $100 million, what are you going to spend it on? Might donate some to charity, you know, pay off my parents' mortgage, buy a nice car, travel, and then invest the rest. What? You'll invest the rest? But you've got $100 million. Why do you need to invest it? So we have inbuilt this desire to have bigger barns and better things. So yeah, you've got $100 million, but guess what? You invest some of that, you can make a bit more. The question was $100 million plus your investments. Just $100 million. It's hardwired to get more and to be greedy and just to have a little bit more, because if you've got $100 million, why not have $100 million plus 10% annually with the, you know, the compounding? Like, why not have more? Science, math. So Solomon, it's ingrained in him. His wisdom doesn't block this out. He wants more. So he gets his horses and he starts to lose sight of this money thing. But there's a bigger issue. Number three. He's very famous for this issue. Come to chapter 11. We're going to have some more reading. And we're going to read verse 1 to 8, because it's all very important and explains the issue pretty concisely. I don't care who reads. Why not this? Maybe some people from this side. 1 Kings 11, verse 1 to 8, share it around. Or that side, I don't mind at all. Laura McKinley is looking like she wants to read. Phil, can you read? Can you read? Okay. Thank you.
Now King Solomon loved many foreign women along with the daughter of Pharaoh. Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women.
Keep reading if you want to. Yep. 1 to 8. Pay attention to the things that Solomon are doing.
What? Oh, you're saying me to pay
attention. Pay attention, Ben. All right. I know you're reading for me. Everyone else pay attention to Brett, to Ben.
From the nations concerning which the Lord has said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love. He had 700 wives who were princesses and 300 concubines. And his wives turned away his heart. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods. And his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not fully follow the Lord as David his father had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mountain east of Jerusalem. And so he did for all his foreign wives who made offerings and sacrifice to their gods.
Okay, so here's Solomon's big issue. Big is probably an understatement. Solomon had an obsession. Solomon loved women, many, many women, 1,000 women. Is it 700 wives and 300 concubines, or the other way around? I actually don't know. Yep, 700 wives. You know, Solomon wrote a book called Ecclesiastes, and in it, he basically sets out to find the meaning of life. What's it all about? What's important in life? And he goes out and he tries all these different things. He experiences it all. And obviously, His obsession with marrying women and with these women was a big part of that. He did it all. He tried it all. And these wives, these concubines, were a huge problem for him. So what did they do to him? What happened to Solomon? Well, what started with just maybe one political marriage to the daughter of Pharaoh, which, by the way, he was already married with a kid, with another woman when he marries Pharaoh. This quickly got out of hand to the point where it was 1,000 different women. You know, one wife was fine, then it was 2, 4, 6, and 1,000. It was really a big problem. And the issue was that when he started, Solomon didn't set out to be an idolater like he ended up at the end. He didn't set out to start offering idols, and offering to Chemosh and Ashtaroth and Baal and the rest of them. He didn't start out with a bad intention, but it grew. It was a slow, slow process by which, by the time he was old, in 1 Kings 11, his wives had turned his heart. So this was something that started in his life as very small, but it grew. And it took a lifetime, but it grew until it consumed him and it turned him away from God. So I often like to talk about, and Daniel and Johnny know this well, our minds being a garden. And our minds being a finite space where only so much can grow. So you think about it, our brains are physically limited. So there's a physical limit to the amount of things that we can concentrate on, watch, see, listen, experience before something gets removed while we fill it in with new things. So the more we're putting in, the more that's being pushed out, whether for good or for bad, regardless of what it is. So Solomon, for Solomon and these wives that he was marrying, and the more he allowed these wives to take up his time, and the more he allowed them to spread their pagan idolatry, even just talking would be enough. This is a lifetime of zero weeding in the garden of his mind. He just allowed them to grow. And he would put them up in a house maybe or in a palace, you know, miles away, until all of a sudden his entire kingdom all over with these temples and these altars to these foreign gods. That he didn't set out to make it like that, but it just happened because he didn't keep track of it. He didn't give God and God's ways and God's laws and God's commandments. He didn't keep a copy of the law in his heart. There wasn't room. He didn't give God the mental real estate and the headspace. And so of course Solomon was going to fall. Of course his wives were going to take up his time with their idolatry. And eventually his faith wore down and he fell into idolatry. It's like it's like growing weeds in a garden. It doesn't happen overnight. You know, you don't freshly plough a garden and fertilize it and dig it up and then you come back the next day and you've got a 3-foot thistle in it. It doesn't happen like that. It's a slow process. And you know, that's a very hard thing to be told. Because often, because it's so slow and insidious and hidden, you don't notice it. So just think about in your life, and in our life and in my life, what are some of the things that may be growing in your mind? Things that you're watching, that you're listening to, places that you're going, words that you're saying, things that you're thinking about even. What are they causing to grow in your mind? What are they taking up space? What are you putting in that's pushing God out? Are you in a good space right now? Are you taking in heaps of what God has to offer? You're reading your Bible, you're praying, you're singing, you're meditating, just thinking about God. That's great. That's mental real estate. Because the more you do that, the less room there is for other stuff. But it goes both ways, doesn't it? And Solomon found that. So we need to have a look at ourselves and identify those things in our minds. Okay, we're going to start to wrap up because I've gone over time. Okay, I just want to finish lastly in the book of Ecclesiastes. So come there. It can be a hard one to find. If you've got this Bible, or the old-fashioned one, it's page 846. It's before Song of Solomon, and it's after Proverbs, if that's any help. When you go to the last chapter in Ecclesiastes. So Solomon, with all this experience, and Solomon with all his wisdom, and all his knowledge, he writes a book and he calls it Ecclesiastes. And it's basically, like we said before, what is the meaning of life? Arguably the biggest question of all. And he tries to answer this one question with all his resources. Why are we here? What's the meaning of life? And after much experimentation, you know, he builds buildings, he makes all these public works, he eats really nice food, he travels, he learns about science, he learns about all these other things, he marries 1,000 women, he does all these things because he's got the resources, and he says, you know what I found after I tried everything, after I'd done everything, because I could do it just because I could and I had the wisdom and I wanted to know? What was the purpose and what was the meaning behind all that experience? He says it was vanity. Vanity. Another word for vanity is emptiness. It's a vapor. It's breath. It's a breath of air. It's nothing. All that experience, all that experimentation, all that worldly knowledge, all of it was just a gust of wind, a breath of air. Here one day and gone the next. You might live a really prosperous, virtuous life, but when you die, you're dead. You don't know about it. That's what Solomon found. So in some ways, it's quite a depressing book, but he ends it very interestingly, and we're going to end here as well. So Solomon's lived this full life. He's done good and he's done a lot of bad. He's made a lot of mistakes, especially in this last part of his life. And he says, he's answered these questions I've been asking. Chapter 12, verse 13. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. The conclusion of the whole matter. What's the conclusion? Well, it's simple. Fear God and keep his commandments. That's the duty. That's the whole duty of mankind. Very, very simple. Fear God, keep his commandments. That is your whole duty. Forget about everything else. Not forget about it, but don't let that take over. This is what's important. Fear God and keep his commandments. And that encapsulates everything that's involved with that. That's more than understanding God. That's more than understanding his commandments. That's doing his commandments. It's more than just having God's wisdom and finding God's wisdom and reading about God's wisdom and trying to get it. It's then living that wisdom. That's keeping his commandments. That's the whole duty of mankind. So that's what I want to leave us with. Solomon was a wise man. He had a lot of experience. And he says, You want to try what the world has to offer? You want to know what's out there? You want to know what it is? You know what's so good that's out there? I did it all. I tried it all. It was all emptiness, and this is what's important. Fear God and keep his commandments. Let's learn from Solomon.